Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
It's me, your host, Dave Ettler. Welcome back to the Short Code Podcast. And more importantly, I'm here with medical student Terrence Wong. Hi, Terrence.
Hello. How's it going?
I'm all right. Terrence, usually aside from me, everybody else on the mic for the Short Code Podcast are students, but not this week. This week, we're joined by a woman who needs no introduction, but because few students have actually met her, I think we really ought to introduce her. Megan McDowell, right?
Yep.
Is our newly hired Learning Communities Coordinator. She went to the University of Arizona, where she majored in education, got her MA in higher ed and student affairs at the University of Iowa. She's taught high school chemistry. She's worked with high school students on leadership development. She's also a former coordinator of the Women in Science and Engineering Living and Learning Community Coordinator here at the UI, right?
Yep.
And worked at the Center for Student Involvement and Leadership Institute. And she's literally been on the job for 5 days. And I think she's already made incredible strides. Megan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, what's the past five? What have you learned in the past 5 days about the College of Medicine?
You need a healthcare ID to get on the network.
They're serious about that.
Yeah, I feel like that's been part of my challenges. I've learned a lot. I've learned all the fun acronyms for all your classes. You know, people are talking MOHD and all those fun things, and you're like, what is
this place is lousy with acronyms. It is insane.
I'm starting to catch on. So.
Good. Yeah. Good.
I'm impressed because as a second year, I still don't know what most of my classes are called yet. So I'm very impressed.
Be proud.
Oh, acronyms. Yeah. But that and meeting with people, getting to know people's faces. I'm excited. Students will be back around a little bit more next week. So excited to meet all them.
I think that students would like to know what the learning coordinator position is all about. Have you distilled that down yet? Do you have it?
Well, it's a brand new position, so I think we'll still be kind of figuring that out as we continue to go along. But right now it's kind of working mostly with the community mayors and the other leadership teams and the faculty directors and figuring out how we can make each individual learning community more effective, but also working across them and streamlining some of those processes so that everybody can have like a mentoring opportunity or whatever it happens to be.
Cool.
Sounds like you're trying to create opportunity for people,
yeah.
Right?
Yep, I have a lot of background, as kind of Dave talked about, in terms of helping students increase their leadership potential and be better leaders, and that's incredibly important in medicine. So,
I think here's what your challenge is going to be. I'm going to predict this.
You tell
me in 6 months, we'll check in. We're going to get a whole new crop of M1s in about 3 days.
Yes.
And they're all going to be very excited. And then, kablam, the classes will begin. And they are going to hunker down and you won't see them, which is, in hindsight, from probably the perspective of, from your perspective, Terrence, might be a bit of a sadness because the way you're going to get the most out of medical school is to really be involved not only in your studies, but in the other stuff that is available to you, student orgs, all that kind of stuff. I see that. I think that's going to be your challenge because this is typical.
That's always the challenge.
Yeah.
Students always, there's a common saying, I think when you work with student orgs, it's you try and tell students they get what they put into it. So if they put it in some effort, they're going to get tenfold back.
Yeah, totally agree. And there's such a depth of activities, breadth and depth of activities. In medicine, that it's just amazing what you can do and what you can get involved with as a medical student.
It just seems like, to me at least, it's a fine line for balance. And I think that when you're in med school, there's such a huge skew towards sitting in a box and studying for hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we forget, and I'm guilty too, we forget that there's other things too outside of that. And sometimes it's possible even to feel that we lose that person inside that you feel makes you unique. So what are some of your plans, Megan, in terms of helping me tether that?
Yes.
That balance.
Terrence is your client.
I think, first of all, just understanding that you can still be a really good student and be a good professional and sometimes it's important to say, no, I can't do that, or taking time for yourself. That kind of work-life balance is incredibly important, regardless of if you're in medical school or a graduate student or a professional out there in the world. And so figuring out, you can't have that balance skew one way or the other to be fully functioning. So if you're not having those outside outlets, you're not going to probably be as good at studying, because your brain will get overloaded. And all we know about learning, it's great to take breaks. So and let that creativity flow and have those kind of things that you're passionate about continue.
So take an hour over lunch. Take a break between your, you know, during your hour lunch break, and take part in something. Do something other than study.
Oh, definitely.
It's hard to remember that. Can you send me text messages every day at noon to remind me?
That's a great idea. There's your big idea.
We can put the text messages, and I can send you an email over your text message.
Yeah. It's going to be really hard to send
automated.
It's going to be really hard to send 700 text messages over lunch, but hey, that's not my problem.
What's interesting is that med school is the first time in my life, at least, where I had to have my school tell me not to study. You need to stop studying right now. It's bad for you. It's funny. It's really funny.
I never thought of that before. I don't know why I never thought of that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's important. So.
So do you have any big goals?
Right now, my big major goal is, I think, just getting to know people and getting to know kind of what we do well here, because I don't want to come in as an outsider and just shake the bottle and everything explode. It's really important to value the people that are already here and the things that have been done. And from my understanding, there's a lot of great things that have happened, like the bench press contest and Doc Dash and all these other things that I'm slowly learning about. I watched the video of a fashion show from the Bean community from, I think that was 2007.
2000, long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was interesting to see students and see the involvement that they've had over years.
I want to pull back for a second and look at the big picture, because you do have experience with other learning communities.
I do.
And these learning communities are kind of a thing in higher education in the past few years. What's driving that?
We know that if we can give, really create community, first of all, by taking your class sizes and making them a little bit smaller, making it a designated community, but also having something common that'll come through. So my understanding that each kind of community here has a different philanthropy that they're kind of heavily involved in. And so it gives them something to come together. More so at the undergraduate level, the living learning communities are really popular. And so where they kind of bring school into their home. So when I was working with the Women in Science and Engineering Living Learning Community, we brought a lot of faculty members. We did a lot of Sunday night dinners and brought in female faculty from the university, both sides of the river, to really kind of have informal conversations. And it's about creating those relationships. Most of the research has to do with the success of learning communities when you couple with faculty, and creating those relationships outside of the classroom will help you be more successful inside the classroom.
For those of our listeners, you said, for those of our listeners who aren't here at Iowa, you said both sides of the river.
Oh, yes.
And so in Iowa City, there is a river that runs right through the university and literally splits the campus in half almost between the undergraduate, between the health science campus and the rest of the campus. So the other side of the river is used on both sides of the river to say those people over there who we have no idea what's going on.
In other words, one side is the bars, and the other side is where learning happens.
Oh,
we'd hope that some learning happens on that other side too.
Great. I'm so glad you could join us today for the podcast, and that you weren't too shy to say no. We're gonna take a quick break, and we'll be right back on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Hey, so I just wanted to share something in my life that's been happening recently. Something that I've been working on for the past I think over past year or so. So I've been mentoring this student, my friend. He's from Oakland, California, which is one of the places that I grew up. And my friend, he's a pre-medical student. He wants to be a doctor, and he's been working really hard towards getting into med school. And you know, he's been to college, he's done grad school, and he had a really big event happen in his life at a really bad time. Not that there's a good time for these things to happen. So he was gonna take the MCAT a month ago, and a few weeks or a month before that, his cousin was murdered, and it's one of the, I mean, I think it's safe to say that he was devastated, and just to be in that environment, like that state of mind, it's really difficult to be able to focus on such a big test while simultaneously juggling this, because he's also he takes care of his family too, and it's difficult because he moved out to Pennsylvania to try to further his career for grad school, but his family's in California.
So he already had a burgeoning career in medicine? Is that true?
No. He's a student.
So he's still a student. Okay.
Yep. And he's trying to break into that.
Trying to get into.
Yep.
All right.
Trying to get into med school. And it's just, I guess I just wanted to share because it's something I wouldn't say I'm struggling with now, because I think that in my mind, at least, I've been able to come to a place where I'm okay with how things worked out in my life. But I definitely feel that I understand his position, and I feel that it's something that would be valuable to our community in medicine to discuss. But I remember the feelings of when I was, you know, a young kid in Oakland and running around doing stuff, my friend getting murdered, and, you know, for such a dumb reason, not that there's a good reason, but, you know, he was in the wrong neighborhood wearing the wrong colors, and, you know, there's a few guys that weren't so nice and decided that they wanted to take certain actions to end his life. And when things like this happen, it really hits close to home for me, because I feel that I'm in a very fortunate position. I don't feel that I'm any, you know, better or superior to anyone in that type of position. I just, honestly, if you asked me, I think that I'm just lucky. I don't think that I was special in any way to get to where I am today in med school. But it's just been kind of weighing heavy on me, because I feel that I've been able to offer him advice and mentoring, but I feel that sometimes that's not enough. I wish that I could do more for my friend.
Can we get it into your background just for a second? Is that all right?
I've never talked about it in public, so
I mean,
it might not come out fluently.
Well, that's okay. Like I say, we're not NPR, but were you in a place where we're talking about gang violence here. We haven't actually said that yet.
Yeah.
Were you in a place in Oakland where that was an everyday concern for you personally?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question, because when I was a kid, it wasn't much of a concern because I didn't know any other world other than that. And it wasn't until I got to college that I realized that, you know, this is not how life is for everybody in the world.
Where'd you go to school? Where'd you go to college?
I went to Cal State East Bay in Hayward.
Okay, so is that removed in some sense from Oakland?
So in the Bay Area, all the cities are fairly close. Hayward's like maybe 20 minutes driving. Mm-hmm. So it's far enough, and we're at the top of a hill, which is nice. So it was a nice, for me, I was able to live in a library. And when I got to college, I never really studied ever in my entire life. Until college. So it was a nice place for me to, sometimes I think of it as being born again. That previous life was, you know, younger Terrence, and there's this new person who evolved from that.
So I imagine for your friend who is, you haven't said whether he himself, or whether even his friend was, involved in a gang, particularly, but what we know is that they were affected by this sort of atmosphere, and that, you know, everybody, maybe perhaps everybody who's in is in that environment needs to sort of, in a sense, struggle to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So here's this guy who's, you know, making good on that, and then bam, it drags him back in. That must be devastating.
Yeah, and these type of neighborhoods, you might not be in a gang, but you're involved with gangs.
Yeah, yeah. It's all around you, maybe.
Yeah, and you might not be in the gang, but your uncle might be, or your brother might be, or your dad might be, or someone in your family was shot, or someone in your family was robbed or stabbed or whatever. And there's just this constant thing. And the biggest piece of advice that I've tried to convey to him is to not want to seek revenge, because when my friend was murdered, my best friend, I had a lot of hatred in my heart, and I wanted to go out there and find those guys and redistribute some of that hurt that I was feeling onto them and their family members. But luckily I didn't. And again, it's not due to, you know, my being able to control my emotions or anything like that. I think I just got, I got lucky in that sense. But I wanted to convey that to him. And I think so far, so we've agreed to, for him to, you know, give the MCAT another shot. So he's scheduled for another test this month. And I'm going to send him some money to cover his living for a little while so that, you know, it can sort of restore some normal back into his life, although that's impossible.
Sure. Yeah. Have you thought about what you or just medical professions in general can do, or people in the medical profession can do in general to sort of, because this is a this is actually a pretty big public health problem in ways that are similar to, you know, diseases or other things like that. I mean, it really affects whole communities. So there's got to be ways for healthcare professionals to get involved and mitigate the problems associated with gang violence.
Yeah. As a future doctor, I think that our profession holds a certain weight in society, and we have a certain position that we can speak and people will listen. And we had a podcast on this, I think a couple weeks ago
yeah,
about doctors doing not necessarily medically related things, but to use their voice, because the community listens to doctors to address some of these issues. If you were to ask me what I would do today, the answer truthfully is I don't know, but I do have, my heart is set out to find that answer, and my ears are propped up, sort of like the ears of a dog when you call its name. I'm listening and I'm trying to find something that I feel would be effective, really effective. And I'm not talking about, you know, not to say that serving soup at a kitchen is a bad thing, because it's not, it's great. But more than that, doing something, and you interpret this how you will, that would do something for real, something really that can change lives.
So I probably had maybe an hour to look into this morning after you mentioned it. And what I found is that, there are things that people are, that medical professionals are doing in their communities to help with this problem. And some of them are big and some of them are small, you know, like, on the small side, it's the American,
Dave's shuffling through papers.
There's a website, tarrant.txnetworkofcare.org. So this is based in Texas, hence the TX. And they're a network of healthcare providers in Texas, hospitals and practices. And, you know, I've seen these questions, they suggest some questions that pediatricians can ask all of their patients. And I don't think they came up with this. I think this is an American Academy of Family Practice set of questions. But, you know, things like, do you feel safe in your neighborhood? What would you do if you needed protection? Do you have access to a weapon? Which, sadly, in Florida, that question is not allowed. And what is the person has tattoos or is sort of distinctively dressed, what is the significance of your tattoo, your style of clothing? Do you have friends or siblings who are involved in a gang? So those kinds of screening questions can be asked, and then healthcare professionals then, of course, need to be aware of appropriate referral sources, resources for youth. But then I was looking at a nurse website, Modern Nursing, I think it's called. Yep, no, MinorityNurse.com. And this nurse, Dinah Ramirez in Illinois, in Chicago, of the Illinois Hispanic Nurses Association, decided that she needed to do something about gang violence in Southeast Chicago. So she's the co-chair of Southeast Chicago Anti-Gang Initiative, and she's the coordinator of Healthy South Chicago Coalition. And they sent out a survey a while back to help identify community concerns so that this Healthy South Chicago Coalition could plan such like services like after school programs. But they were surprised, or maybe not so surprised, when they got back that the most common concern people had was about youth gangs and youth violence. And they were like, oh, well, we don't quite know what to do about that. And social service agencies, she says, usually exclude high-risk teenagers. Healthcare providers exclude high-risk teenagers because they have a fear of gangs that might show up in, you know, it might show up in the ER for treatment and things like that.
Yeah.
So they have sought to do things in their community to prevent, you know, to sort of address that fear, and also to address people who, you know, young people who, you know, don't have access to preventative care and who, you know, end up in the ER, maybe even just for regular, for routine care, like a lot of people do, but also because of traumatic incidents. So for those who use the emergency room as their primary source of care, they might, you know, suggest resources, but they're also getting exposed to people in the healthcare industry, and they're using that as a stepping stone to say, hey, you can, you know, here's another path for you.
Yeah.
Things like that.
One tough thing is, from my experience at least, is no matter how far out you get, there's always that pressure because we are tied to our families, and it's hard to disband your family members from your life, even if logically sometimes that might be the best thing for yourself and your future family if you ever try to create one of your own. And it's a strong pressure. It's a really strong pressure to pull you back in. And it's something that I feel young people trying to make this transition need to be aware of. Like when I first started off college in Hayward, I severed contact with everyone, all of my friends, everyone. I started over because that was the best thing for me at the time. And it was tough because, you know, I changed my phone number, but they knew where I lived. They knew where my family members were. And something that was, so a couple years after this, after I finished about my sophomore year in college, I was watching the news, and this segment came up where this gang was busted by the FBI. They had this big raid with the SWAT team, and, you know, that whole bit, you know, that you see on TV. And I remember the experience very distinctly. I was looking at the screen, and I remember the hierarchy, the tree that they have for the entire organization, if you want to call it that. And I remember all those pictures of those guys that I knew. I mean, these guys were friends. And the guy at the top, you know, he was a year younger than me. And, you know, I used to kind of poke fun at him. And, you know, that's what we did.
Yeah.
You
knew this guy.
Yeah. And it was just... It's weird when you see these, when you see people you don't know on TV, on the news, there's a disconnect that exists. You think, okay, this person's a bad person. They're going to go to jail. Okay, done. And I'm going to carry on my life now. But when you see these people and you know these people, it's more than that. You know, these guys, I knew these guys, and they're not bad guys. They're not. They're smart guys who, you know, I mean, I'm not saying they never did anything wrong. I'm not saying that. That's not a claim I'm trying to make. But it's just, it's difficult, I think.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, as you've been talking, Terrence, I keep thinking of, have you read the book, The Other Wes Moore?
Mm-mm.
It's about a kid named Wes Moore and another kid named Wes Moore who grew up a couple hundred miles apart, both in New York and Baltimore area, where gang violence is also incredibly prevalent. And one ended up going on to become a Rhodes Scholar, and the other... is in life, in prison for life. So, and it kind of exploring their very similar but different paths and how they ended up. And I think that he's a person, not necessarily in the medical community, but in the professional community, who's gone about thinking about and talking about gang violence and those different paths that people are able to take, mm-hmm. in a really positive way, and has a lot of good recommendations. So that might be a book I recommend to you. It's a pretty short read.
Wes Moore.
The Other Wes Moore.
The Other Wes Moore.
Yeah. And that can maybe help you start thinking about and processing how to, as you said earlier, kind of do something about this.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I really keep thinking about is a lot of gang violence is tied to our perceptions of masculinity in society. And so I think to truly, truly change how violence is so prevalent in those communities, we need to start talking about what it means to be a man. And having positive role models like yourself is always going to be a positive impact in that.
That's definitely a thing. Carrying heat, as people say, or carrying a gun definitely makes you feel like a man. That's for sure. That's definitely a thing.
I wonder if, you know, some of that, I don't want to get too into psychoanalyzing you know, people who are in gangs, but, you know, there's definitely that that economic factor as well. I should think, in some communities where, you know, there are depressed economies and, you know, if one's masculinity might be tied up in, you know, providing or being able to provide, and that isn't there, mm-hmm. then maybe that's an issue too. Here's a small thing that I was intrigued to find. Walla Walla General Hospital in Washington, provides for free removal of drug and gang-related tattoos. So for people who are trying to get out, one problem is that, you know, if they're covered in tattoos or other body art that basically says to the world, you know, you're in a gang.
Yeah,
it's going to be really hard to claw your way out of it, to climb out of it, because you won't be able. It'd be much harder for you to get a job, and so this organization, Ink Out, was founded by Dr. Robert Betts. He's an obstetrician and gynecologist. And, you know, he realized that they can't get out of gang life. People don't want to hire them. So they put together a plan that led to a $70,000 grant. You know, basically they allow people to get free tattoo removal. The money goes, they also charge a fee to people who just want to get rid of tattoos. Mm-hmm. But that money goes back into Ink Out. So this is a small way that healthcare mm-hmm. providers can do something, you know.
And I think that's a fantastic example. But that's not to negate what you just said. That's sort of one of the, like you said, it's a small thing you feel. And I agree, it's a great thing. But it is in magnitude small.
Yeah,
and
well.
I think it's fixing a broken arm with a Band-Aid, right? Mm-hmm. When I say that the world is unequal, that socioeconomic status is a huge risk factor for mostly everything, right?
Yeah.
That's not a new idea. Everyone knows about this. I know about it. You know about it. Inequality exists. But that's what I'm talking about at that systemic level.
Yeah. So you've got to fix the economic problems, fix the societal issues that are
which is frustrating, because I don't feel that I'm at a point in my life, or I'll ever be at a point in my life, where I'll have the power to do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough, because like when you're a young guy, you don't necessarily think about, you know, your future or having kids or, you know, being a good role model for your you know, family members and stuff like that, right? And sometimes it just takes one mistake and your life is ruined. I'll give you an example. Like when I was a kid, you know, we didn't have money for things. So as a kid, I stole stuff. I fought all the time. You know, when I went to school to fight this kid that, you know, looked at me funny or stepped on my shoes or whatever. And that's why I keep saying that, you know, I feel lucky. I'm lucky that I didn't go to prison for that. Because if you go to jail, you're going to have it on your record, and that's it. And you're never going to be able to go to med school.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, even if you go to jail as a juvenile and your record is sealed,
mm-hmm.
sometimes going to jail begets more crime, and, you know, for somehow, and,
yep.
and you may end up in this, you know, you may have been, end up committing more crimes, and, you know, it's, you're right. It's, sometimes it's about luck as much as,
yeah,
at least as much as, you know, some sort of intentional act, or, you know, act.
Yeah, and it's like that peer pressure is really strong. Like if your like homie is gonna go do something, right, and he asks you, hey, are you coming with? Like you said, the whole theme of masculinity, you don't want to be the guy who doesn't go, because that's gonna make your life bad. It's gonna make your life really bad. So
it's also just a teenage thing too, like
just the roll with.
It's I mean, that's what they do. I mean, this is why people are.
Yeah.
You heard of the fire challenge?
What's the fire challenge?
It's like people squirting alcohol on themselves and videotaping themselves lighting themselves on fire.
Sounds
because
dark.
It's cool. If they'll do that, you know, yeah, why not go to the dangerous thing that, you know, your buddies are planning to do. Teenagers are crazy anyway.
Yeah. One outlet for me has always been music. So rap music, hip hop music for me has always been therapy, and it still is today. I listen to the same songs over and over and over and over. And my relationship with these songs as time goes on and I get older and I grow, my mind, my thought processes change and evolve. My relationship with the music changes. And again, I've been listening to the same songs for years. Songs that I listen to.
Like what?
Yeah, what songs are we talking about?
Don't get me started, but people like Jay-Z and Puff Daddy before he became...
P. Diddy.
P. Diddy and just Diddy. He had actually, it's a tangent, but he had a really great quote. He said, it was like on an interview or something, but he said, when too many people know your name, it's time to change your name. So he claims that's why he changes his
name. Fair enough.
And you know, like Tupac. I love these guys. I love these guys, and it's just the things that they speak about, to me, it speaks volume, because I feel that they understand sort of the struggles and that perspective.
Is there a particular song that really kind of has your heart in mind?
Oh, there's too many songs.
Okay.
Just give one. Come on. Bring it on.
Oh, so right before every exam, I always listen to Tupac,
mm-hmm.
and there's kind of this ritual that I do. He has a song called... So Many Tears, where
that's a good song.
He describes just the struggle of watching your friends get killed, things like that. There's a song called I Ain't Mad At Ya, and it's about, you know, he talks, there's one particular part that I feel I really identify with, where he's describing his relationship with his friend. His friend, you know, went away to prison, and when he came out, he became a Muslim, he became a religious man, he got married, had kids, and he just totally changed. And Tupac, you know, he's talking to his friend. He's saying, hey, you know, I got this great plan. We can make all this money, and it's easy. And this is the scheme. This is how we're going to do it. And he'll describe this plan to his friend. But his friend just isn't interested, because he's, you know, a different man now. But at the same time, Tupac, you know, he understands. He's like, you know, I ain't mad at you. I get it. You know, your path isn't my path, but we're still homeboys, and it's all good. But I run through this. It's a ritual for me every Friday.
So it's clear that you're yes, you're out of Oakland. You're out of this life, but you're still working on it.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
And your friend will be too. And I don't know. Hopefully things will turn out great for him. I think he's got to start in a guy like you to sort of give him that perspective, because a lot of times that's what it's sometimes, I don't know. Okay. So I'm not never been in this situation. I don't know that I can say this for sure, but, sometimes it's just about having the perspective to, or getting, or being in a position to get the perspective to know that,
mm-hmm.
you know, things can change. You can do it. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be simple, but it's the possibility exists.
Yeah. It's just, I've been feeling very, down about it, because for the past year I've been his cheerleader. Been in his corner cheering him on, and you know, when he takes like a practice test and he'll do well on a section,
mm-hmm.
you know, he'll email me, and I'm just, you know, I try to cheer him on. I'm trying to be that person in his life, and there are so many examples of that, and the excitement that he felt, these are all, you know, feelings that I felt, and so I know exactly where he's coming from. And just to see how all that kind of was thrown away so far, not permanently. I hope not permanently. And I believe in him. I think he can do it. But, you know, when he got his score back and it wasn't good, you know, it affected me as much as it affected him. I feel that I failed him, and I feel bad. I feel like I could have done more. So it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine so.
But you're right. It's a lifelong thing, I think. As it should be. I don't want to forget about it. You know, at one point in my life, I wanted to forget about it. And I just don't think that's the right way to live. You know, how my mentors here, you know, they told me, you should be yourself and speak your mind. You shouldn't hide who you are. And that's
what it's, I mean, for better or for worse, it's what makes you the person you are. It informs mm-hmm. your worldview. And if you're not, I imagine if you're not paying attention to that,
mm-hmm.
you're losing a part of yourself. You're denying a part of yourself.
Yeah, and hopefully you can pay it forward, and that's what I'm trying to do with my friend, and you know, in terms of like my personal life, I'm trying to do that with my family members and my girlfriend, trying to be that person for her and for them. You know, the person that my dad wasn't, because my dad was the alcoholic, yell at everyone, hit my mom type of person. And you know, that's not the person that I want to be. And so I feel that in a way, he's a great like anti role model. So
I always say some people are out there to show you how not to be.
Yeah. Yep. And so, you know, like it like seeps down to your everyday life, even sitting here or, you know, hanging out, cooking dinner with my girlfriend and just trying to be like a good guy, whatever that entails.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing this up. I think that, you know, I'm not quite sure that I'm able to put it into perspective for myself at this point. But it sounds like, you're pushing hard for it. You're making, and hopefully you're making some strides with your friend too. And you know, I want to wish you both the best of luck.
Thank you. As we're talking, I actually thought of a few things that I actually do have a couple of strategies to save
that.
The world. When I was in college, I was part of this program called the McNair Scholar Program.
It's a great program.
Yep. And it's after the astronaut, Ronald E. McNair, who died on the Challenger, created a scholars program to help disadvantaged students fund things for conferences and research and stuff. And that was in college my way to travel around the world because I had no other means. But I was able to travel the entire country presenting at conferences and seeing the world and seeing different cultures and communities. And stuff like that I think is important. But it's really sad because that program at my school, at least, was shut down due to funding. Mm. So, and that's not the only program that was shut down. I mean, think of all the other things that happened when, you know, Congress signed something into law that, you know, that's the budget this year. So some things have to go. And typically it's the social things that go, right?
Social programs.
Social programs go.
Some people, they're lifelines for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yep. When I was a kid, you know, free lunch at school. Oh, I love free lunch at school. It was good. It was good stuff. It was hot. It was good stuff. Chocolate milk. Oh, I love chocolate milk.
Well, again, thank you so much. Good luck to you and your friend. And sounds like, you know, y'all doing your best.
Yep, trying to.
All right.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming, Megan.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
All right. Hope we can hear from you more in the future.
I'm sure you will.
All right. Probably because I will attack you in the hallway.
And I'll say, well, okay.
Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Yetler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. But what I see is a child.